Well, it is a fact, a scientifically proven fact, that I am allergic to clutter and junk. And it's also a fact that my wife seemingly delights in that. Now, I want to be very clear, because after the first service, some folks got irritated with me for saying that about my wife. I wasn't trying to be rude to her, and it wasn't her that said that to me. We're not dealing with our marital conflict in public here. But it's something that is endearing about her in some sense now. But it wasn't 16 years ago. And this issue has been a source of marital conflict for nearly 17 years now. We realized it was going to be an ordeal in our first year of marriage. We were living in the married dorms at the Bible college I attended, and we had been given a small place in our attic where we were supposed to store our stuff that wouldn't fit in our apartment. And I noticed that our stuff had begun to overflow in other people's storage area. I would have to go up there to get books. I would have to go up there to get things that I needed. And I realized that just within a year of marriage, the stuff that we had was out of control, mainly because of my wife's stuff. When I married her, her dad said, "Here is my daughter and all of her stuff, all of her junk from the time she was a baby till now. You get it all." And so I had to load up the U-Haul, take all of her stuff to this little bitty apartment, this little bitty place. And one Saturday, I realized as this stuff was growing that she hadn't been up there in months and that we had not touched the stuff in months. And so I thought it was the perfect opportunity, in light of such logic, to get rid of a lot of stuff. And so what I did throughout that day was take boxes down to the dumpster behind our apartment and just started tossing it in there. I didn't know what was in it, and I didn't think she did either. She hadn't been up there in such a long time. Surely she was never going to realize that these heirlooms from her grandmother, that this jewelry that had been handed down, that these blankets from her childhood would be missing. She didn't even know what was up there. Well, I was wrong. I was wrong. Later that evening, we were talking, you know, "What did you do today?" "I studied. I cleaned up around here. I tossed some boxes in the dumpster. How was your day?" And then several hours later, I was out in the dumpster trying to retrieve the stuff that I had tossed in the dumpster. But this episode in our marriage, this episode that some of you are probably even reliving, men are thinking through your attics, you're thinking through your storage units, you're thinking through the crawl space, the garage. Those sorts of episodes reveal something about us, and it reveals something about our stuff, and it's not neutral. Stuff is never neutral. It's not just something you have and you put away. It's something that evokes feelings. It's something that evokes action. It's something that reveals, at the end of the day, who you are. It's not neutral. We were very poor at the time. Much of our stuff was not expensive. A lot of it was old. Not much of it was new. But it revealed something about both of us. I was an insensitive jerk, and she was a hoarder, which, but it wasn't neutral. But the way we think, the way we use stuff reveals something. First of all, we see in our text about our identity. Notice Jesus says, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth." Literally, do not store up, do not stock up. Here he says, don't treasure. The word for lay up comes from the idea that we get of stacking things on top of one another, making sure they fit, making sure there's enough room, taking advantage of every square inch we are given by stocking stuff. And in the context, this happens when you are fretful over the future. In context, Jesus is speaking to folks who would have to go out and kill a cow to eat. They would have to go out and bring in the crop to have food. Now, and that's why this concept is hard for us to understand. We have a grocery store where we go and we take what we need and put it in a basket and then purchase it. We have McDonald's, we have buttons, we have phones, things that we push, cards that we slide, and voila, there's food on the table. There's food right before us. There's food in our cars. We have what we need, even to an excess. Those of us in here who garden or can, you only do that because it's fun. I often think about the way my grandmother views, you know, these hipsters in Berea. And I mentioned a couple in here in the first. I won't do that again. I'm realizing the sort of folks I offend in the first hour, so I won't do it in the second, unless it's for the sake of the gospel. But I imagine how my grandmother thinks about canning and gardening for fun, someone who had to do it for a living, someone who had to do it to eat. But we don't store what we need, we store what we want. We don't store what we need, we store what we don't want to lose. And Jesus says that this is a revelation of our identity. I mean, think about the ways in which we store in our culture. We store to excess. We'll pay $125 a month to store things that don't fit in our house at a storage unit. We have redneck hoarding. We have uppity hoarding. There are folks in here who store cars that are very, very expensive that they want to keep safe. And then we have folks who leave junk out in front of our front yard, cars that we haven't touched in years. There's storage that goes both ways. There are those of us who keep sentimental things that we want to pass down, and then there are those of us who just keep things. My grandparents, they have a basement full of just junk. It's just awful, and they act like they're going to turn that over to me, and I'm going to be delighted. I dread that day. We're selling the house and everything in it. They think the vacuum that hasn't worked in 20 years, that no one's touched, that someone's going to be delighted to have that dumped on them. But we store excess. We store junk. We store things we don't want to let go of so often. And it doesn't have to be expensive. And it's a witness to our identity. What we acquire and what we have is a witness to our identity. And Jesus says it could be an earthly identity or a heavenly identity. We know how that works, right? How what we have is a testimony to our identity. When I was in high school, it was always what car you drove. Now it's what sort of phone you have or what kind of pair of shoes you have. The other night I was at a baseball practice, and I picked up one of the young man's phones, just sort of moving it out of the way, and it was I actually didn't realize what kind of case he had, and I said, "What is this?" And the kid was embarrassed. He goes, "Oh, it's an old iPhone 3." I was going to ridicule him for not having an iPhone 6. He said, "Yeah, I had an iPhone 6 and I lost it. And then I had an iPhone 5 and I broke it. And now I got this junky old iPhone 3. And I said to him, "You know what my boys have? An iPhone 0. You're okay. They take one of my old phones that they play video games. And just to be cool, they act like that's theirs. Why? Because it's a testimony of identity. It's who you are, what you have, what you acquire. And in our culture, it's to excess. And Jesus says, you have a glorious opportunity, even in the excess. If he would say to those who stored what they needed, certainly he would say to those who store in excess, you have an opportunity to witness something eternal. And you can either witness an earthly identity, he says here, by storing up things, verse 19, on earth, by stacking up things on earth in excess, that things that will be destroyed, he says, by moth and rust and thief. These things are temporary. These things can be destroyed. These things can be ruined by termites. Don't store up. Don't stake your identity on things that are here today and gone tomorrow. And he's addressing the religious leaders of the day, those who would placate to the wealthy. And it was the idea that if you were wealthy, you were religious. And so the wealthy folks came to church, and the religious leaders would make a big deal out of it. When they would give, they would throw coins in, and there would be bells, and there would be whistles, and there would be horns, and look how much this person gave, and they would shake it. And Jesus says, that's all external. That's all earthly. That sort of identity that you're establishing for yourself is like vapor. It's here today and it's gone tomorrow. That's why he says, rather store up treasure in heaven. Stockpile a heavenly identity. In context, Jesus himself is the new Israel out in the wilderness. And remember, Israel was given mammon to survive, or manna to survive. And what did they do in the wilderness? They thought they needed something more. And now Jesus is in the wilderness, and he's living by what? Nothing. He's fasting. And the serpent comes and tempts him, and he says, man shall not live by bread alone, but every word of God. And there's the testimony that God will provide for him. And what he is saying to us here is trust God. You have the gospel. You have the kingdom. God has declared in Christ, he is going to take care of you. In Christ, you are his son. He's going to give you what you need. Witness that as you live in the world. Think about the earthly kingdom you witness when you deceive. When you fudge numbers, when you cheat on your taxes, what are you saying? You are saying here and now, this kingdom is more valuable than the kingdom to come. Think about when you portray this sort of mine attitude about the things that you have. Stay off my lawn. Takes hundreds, thousands of dollars to make it that green. Don't touch my car with that basketball. Think about what you are portraying. You are portraying that those things are more valuable. Those things are most valuable. When you are fretful about security, when you are known as a selfish jerk who pushes others down so that you can get the promotion, when you foolishly go in debt over things you don't have money for, what are you witnessing? The here and now is more valuable than the kingdom to come. And Jesus says, trust the Father is going to take care of you and witness something greater. Work with integrity. Realize your job's not your identity. It's to be used for the kingdom. Use what you have with grace and mercy for the sake of others. Find joy in sacrificing what you have for others. Invest in the kingdom. Act like you're taken care of by a good father who the Bible says, when you ask for bread, he's not going to give you a stone. He's going to give you what you need in life and death. Display that to the world around you. He says here, at the end of the day, this is an issue of the heart. The way we use stuff displays our identity. And then he says here, the way we use stuff is a witness of our heart. Notice verse 21. He says, where your treasure is, on earth or heaven, there your heart will be also. Where you are investing displays something about your heart. Here is a clear statement about what your finances say about who you are. Your finances paint a picture of your spiritual condition. That's that credit card statement. Those things that you're willing to purchase with interest added to it. What does that say about you? It may be a hamburger at McDonald's, or it may be a $500 baseball bat, but it says something about you. It says something about me. Those purchases that make you the happiness, the discontentment that you feel when you look at others who have things that you don't have, the way you talk about things you need. I'm evaluating now, do I need the extra innings package so I can watch all the Braves games this year? Or do I need to save that money every month? But I haven't said, no, this is what I want. But that's the real issue. what you want and what you use your money to get what you want displays something about who you are. He goes on to describe this condition of the heart in verse 22. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. Here he's comparing the eye to the heart. Through your eye, you see where to go. You see what to do. Your body functions and goes in light of the eyes. And he says, if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. You will be able to see. Here, there is a comparison between light and wisdom. And he says, if your eye, your heart is set on the kingdom, you will have the wisdom of the kingdom, and you will live and you will act as if you're in the kingdom. You will be full of light from the kingdom. But he says, but if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Your heart, your eye, that which controls you will be full of darkness. You won't be able to see. And he says, if then the light is in you is darkness, meaning you are blinded, what drives you is darkness and wickedness. How great is the light? You can't even see. You don't know what the kingdom would require. You're not living for the kingdom because you can't see the kingdom. And he says here is if with your heart you are invested in the kingdom, that's going to drive the way in which you spend and invest your money. That's going to drive the way you see your stuff. He's addressing again here the Pharisees, who are called the blind leading the blind, and they're only living for the temporary. They're only doing their religion for the here and now, for themselves. And he says here, with a sick, blind heart, you make foolish decisions. Now we see the way that happens in our culture, right? We can talk about debt all day, foolish temporary decisions that we make because we want things in the moment. I'm always fascinated when the new iPhone comes out, the way people just lose their minds. I mean, you got an iPhone that basically does the same. It basically looks the same. It's a little better. Well, hey, let's change the shape. Well, let's make a little bigger one. Well, let's make it look this way. And people will camp out in front of the Apple store all night for it. I mean, it's going to be there later, right? I mean, you can get one on eBay within a month for about a third of the price. But we do the most foolish things for things we want. And I'm always amazed also when Chick-fil-A does the free biscuits, the way people just go crazy. Tomorrow is free biscuits at Chick-fil-A, and you will waste 3 hours of your morning to get a Chick-fil-A biscuit just because it's free. Well, my time is worth about $3 of standing there, so I will sacrifice that for a biscuit. I said in the last service, again, it wasn't that good. I'll take that back in this service because we have an owner and operator who is in our church. So Chick-fil-A is delicious. You should eat there constantly. For me, it's different. When they constructed the Dick's Sporting Goods that is on my way home from everywhere I go now, and it's the light of the building. I feel like Christian in Pilgrim's Progress at Vanity Fair. It's just, it calls out to me. You need to come in here. You need to look around. You need to purchase something. You need some new baseballs. You need some new equipment. We have Canes. We have Chick-fil-A. We have Culver's that's right there. And you're driving home and there's just something within you that says, yeah, I need something. I don't know what yet, but let me pull in here and figure out what I need to buy. That says something about who we are. And Jesus is explaining the sort of foolish things our heart will call us to do when it is blind to the kingdom. And we have to stop for a moment and be mindful that this is an issue of the heart that he's addressing here. It's an issue of the heart. You can't evaluate this from the outside in. I know a lot of rich people who are godly rich people. And they use their career, they use their status for the sake of the kingdom. I also know a lot of godly poor people who sacrifice and they strategically use every dime for the kingdom. But I also know wicked rich folks. Actually, Jesus said it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom, but he did not say it was impossible. He did not say it was impossible. Why? It's an issue of the heart. And God can change anyone's heart. I know the wicked poor person also who is lazy and discontent and resentful of folks who have things that they don't have. So it's an issue of the heart that you don't always see from the outside in. A few years ago, there was a church, I think it was in Dallas, was constructing a $100 million building. And Christians were just freaking out by that. And it was an easy target, right? It seems audacious to do that. I think it's audacious, and I probably wouldn't agree with much of what they were doing. But I remember talking to Christians about it, and it was just sort of the target that was out there. And I eventually said to one guy, "You're so uptight about this. Do you know what they give to missions? Do you? You're just upset about the $100 million building. Do you know how many people they send out for the sake?" "I don't." "Maybe you do. They probably give the same percentage that you give to missions. They probably give the same sort of amount of to send folks out that you do." But it's so easy to only evaluate that from the outside in. It's so easy to make that an issue of appearance, which is exactly what Jesus is saying don't do. The appearance is earthly, whether it's a rich appearance or whether it's a poor appearance. That's an issue of here and now. The real issue is of the heart. And God can take the heart of a rich person, He can take the heart of a poor person, and they can witness the gospel either way. But He makes clear as we move down to verse 24 that this is not an issue of neutrality. The way you use your stuff witnesses your identity. The way you use your stuff witnesses the condition of your heart. And He says here, the way you use your stuff is a witness of your worship. Notice He says, you can't serve two masters. There is one master who has purchased you, and you are his slave. Therefore, you can't serve someone else. You're going to worship the one and serve the one who has purchased you. He says, for either you will hate the one and love the other. Throughout the book of Matthew, we see Jesus constantly doing that. He's talking about our loves and our hates. And He says, compared to me, your love for me should be so great that your love for other things could be compared to hate. It pales in comparison. And what He is saying here is when it comes to the issue of money, when it comes to the issue of things, you're going to love one and hate the other. Notice He says, or will be devoted. You could even say worship or serve the one and despise the other. He makes it an issue of worship. He makes it an issue of idolatry. He says here, you can't serve God and money, literally mammon, which we would equate to stuff. Someone's value in this cultural context wasn't always apparent by what they had in their bank account or what they had stored out in the backyard. It was evaluated by the number of goats they had, the number of the land they had. People were known for being wealthy by their stuff. And He says here, you can't serve your stuff and Jesus at the same time. You're going to serve one or the other. Now, wouldn't it be a lot easier if Jesus said here, stuff is bad. Stuff is bad. Money is evil. Money is wicked. Wouldn't it be easier if He said it that way? If you are rich, you go to hell. If you are poor, you go to heaven. He didn't make it that easy for us. He speaks to an issue of the heart. That's why the Apostle Paul would write to Timothy and not say, money is the root of all evil. What does he say? A lot of you miss that on Bible trivia and Jeopardy. It's the love. It's the devotion that Jesus speaks here of money, to money, that is evil, that is wicked, that leads to all sort of perverse behavior. We actually read in the scriptures, we see in Psalm 67, Israel praying for God's blessings. God bless us. So it would just resonate on us? No, so that we might bless the nations. And Jesus here is speaking to that issue. He's saying here, you're either going to serve your stuff or Jesus. But he doesn't say it's wrong to have stuff. What he is saying here is we love Jesus and we use money. How often do we get that flipped around? Where we love money and we use Jesus. Often it's use Jesus for more money. No, he says, when that happens, you are a slave to your stuff. You are a slave to money. And he says, what you are to do here is take what God has given you, and instead of worshiping it, use it as a tool to serve Jesus with. Several years ago, I was on a mission trip in the Andes Mountains, and the Peruvian believers were worshiping in it was literally a cardboard box. That's what it was, a cardboard box with wood frame. And I remember being there with a college student who was very haughty and, you know, had just started getting into serving Jesus, and his goal in life was to live in poverty somewhere, and anyone who had money was evil. And he said, Pastor Jeremy, see these people worshiping in this cardboard box? And then we're building a $6 million building in Lexington. That's just not right. And I looked at him and I said, so you're saying we need to build a cardboard box in Lexington? He said, why can't we worship the way they do? And my answer to him was, we don't live in the Andes Mountains of Peru. We live in Lexington. We have a piece of property behind the Fayette Mall. If we put a cardboard box up there, I don't think many people are going to come. And I don't think it's going to be conducive to the surroundings. And actually, I don't think it would honor God to put a cardboard box up there. I think Jesus has blessed us with resources. He has given us what we need to do ministry. Now, we're not going to be extravagant, and we're not going to go over the top, but we are going to use that for a tool for the sake of the gospel. And we're not going to go in and say, hey, don't spill Kool-Aid on the floor. No kids. Don't touch the walls. No, we're going to build that thing and say, tear that thing up for Jesus. I mean, let's bust out the seams there. It's a tool for the sake of the gospel. And many churches confuse that message. The building becomes their God. And yet, what we have is to be a tool. Some questions to ask as you consider your stuff. Consider the things that you own. Are you using it for worship? Are you using your stuff for the sake of the gospel, to witness the gospel? Or are you a slave to your stuff? And by the way, college students have stuff. It may be other people's stuff. Some of you came in here today and you're in college and you don't have much money and you're thinking, I'm the most godly person here today because I'm poor. That's not the case. Somebody's paying for your education. You're working to pay for it. You have an iPhone. You have clothes on today and we're thankful for that. But you have stuff. You have things that are to be used for the kingdom. You got here in something. But does what you have cause you to worship or fret? If you have a nice house, are you constantly fretting about its condition? Or are you constantly thinking about, how can I use this for the sake of the gospel? How can we wear this house out with people in it and using it for the sake of the gospel? Does your stuff cause you to sin? Does it provide an opportunity to sin? Or is it a cause for ministry? Think about the things that you and your spouse talk about, the things that you need to purchase, the way your spending goes, the things that you have. Is it causing ministry? Is it causing gospel focus in your heart? Or is there conflict? What if you came together and said, hey, God has provided us with this much. I'm going to stop yelling and screaming about you spending too much, and you're going to stop spending too much. Did you get that? Not you. I wasn't talking to you. For the sake of the gospel, we're going to stop fighting over stuff because we're going to start using it for the sake of the gospel. We're going to stop committing idolatry. We're going to stop this conflict because we're going to use everything we have for the sake of the gospel. Does your stuff distract you from people, people who are around you, or does it cause you to encourage others? Does that iPhone, is it just sucking you away from everyone around you? That's a thing. That's a thing purchased with money, that stuff. Does that nice man cave at home, does that cause you to run away from people, or do you throw the doors open and say, no, this is a tool for ministry. We're going to have discipleship around a cat's game. It's the way we're going to use our stuff. Stuff is not neutral, but stuff can be wicked if it's not used for Jesus. It becomes ultimate. It becomes an idol. By the way, we talked about this last week. You should work hard. You should work your way up in your company. Some of you come in here today and say, you know, I just can't. Because if I work my way up, that's power, that's pride, then I'm going to be rich, and then I'm going to be wicked. I know some of you are saying that. But you should. And you will protect yourself from pride if you see it as your mission from God to use for the sake of the gospel. You will protect your heart from wickedness when you see it as your mission, the way you connect to the purposes of God. Parents, is your stuff used as an instrument of worship for Jesus, or is it used as an instrument of worship for your kids? You worship your kids by just piling stuff on them. Many folks my age and my parents' age, our goal was to simply make sure our kids had things that we didn't have. And often we forget about the spiritual implications of that. What are you training in your kids? Sacrifice? Or no, that action figure is mine. And in our house, we step in and say, no, it's not. It's mine. Give it here. What are you doing with your stuff to teach your kids about the gospel? I found out just 2 days ago. Well, we were talking about purchasing something, and one of my kids, I said, I'm not getting that for you. And one of my kids said, well, I'll get it for myself. Oh, you will? Well, since when did you get a job? And when did you get money? He goes, well, I have $100 worth of birthday money. And I said, well, you're about to tithe 30% of that. Tithe is 10%, so y'all aren't getting the jokes today. But how are you taking those things that God has entrusted you, and how do you teach your kids to take things that they're entrusted with to serve others, to give for the sake of the gospel? And by the way, it's okay to be poor. It's okay. Actually, it's all God's. And he has allotted some of us with a certain amount. And there are a variety of tests. There are a variety of struggles that are going through this room right now. And we're on all kinds of different levels. And we may be below certain incomes. That's okay. That's your situation. And you trust God there. It may be mistakes. It may be circumstances. But I know this. I know that most of the Christians around the world are living in poverty right now. And they honor Jesus in poverty. Actually, many of them, their faith in comparison to ours would make us look ridiculous. And it's okay. Actually, God may have put you in that situation to display the gospel by trusting him in that way. I remember listening to John MacArthur talk about money one time, and he was actually talking to a group of pastors. And he was talking about the first time he got an extravagant raise from the church in Grace Community where he served. The elders came in, they said, this is what you're going to give you. He said, whoa, 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 no, that is way, way too much. I can't accept that. I don't need that much. And they went back and forth for some time, and finally one of the men stood up and said, we don't care if you need it or not. It's a test. Do you love God or do you love money? And we want a pastor who loves God and not money. And we're going to see that by the way that you manage your money. I mean, feel free to test me anytime you want to. But whatever situation you are in, whether it's rich, whether it's poor, God has put you there to display the gospel. Display the gospel through much. Display the gospel through less. And at the end of the day, even today, what we have displays the glory of Christ, displays a wonderful unity here today. We didn't come in today and say, hey, we're going to give you a giving statement. Here, you need to pep it up a little bit. You haven't given up enough this year. We don't do that. We come in and we just give, and it all becomes one. There are people who give a lot, and there's people who don't give much at all, and that's fine. It's for the sake of the gospel. But at the end of the day, we all give out of our heart. We treasure the kingdom, and so we give for the sake of the kingdom. And some of you think, wow, we talk about money a lot around here. I mean, we basically have a little sermonette before the offering. I mean, you guys want a lot of money. And, I mean, that's not the issue. We don't need a lot of money to do what we do here. But the reason we talk about it is it's a gospel issue. Money and stuff is a gospel issue. It's not neutral. It's saying something about who you are. And what God says to us in the gospel is that you are now my son. As we sung earlier, you were once an enemy, and now you're seated at the table of a father who's going to take care of you. You ask for bread, he's not going to give you a stone. He's not going to give you a snake, is what Jesus says. He's not going to give you something that will be harmful to you. He's going to give you everything that you need. How do you know? Because his son was crucified on a cross for you. How could you look at the cross of Christ and say, God's not going to take care of me? How could you look at the empty tomb and say, God's not going to take care of me? And in light of those things, you can carve some of that other stuff off that you think you need for the sake of the gospel. Because the issue, your greatest issue of provision, has been taken care of in Christ.